The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
If you're someone who lives in an area where it's so expensive to buy real estate and you feel like it's impossible, then I have something for you. I just released a free guide that's going to give you the 8 steps you need to take to buy your first out-of-state property. I've bought several properties out of state, living in California, investing in Ohio, and you can do the same. It's just a matter of having the right information. So click the link in the description of this episode to get your free guide today. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 181. Before we get into this episode, a few quick announcements. If you haven't already, please make sure you leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you're listening to this show. It'll help us go up in the rankings. It'll help us to reach more people and share this message all over the world. So we'll greatly appreciate it. And it'll take you less than 30 seconds. And if you do leave a 5-star rating and review, I will send you a free training on how to find and analyze properties. So if you're someone who's just starting out, you don't really know how to run the numbers and things of that nature, this would be a really great training for you. I'm actually working on a new version of it to match today's interest rates and just what's happening in the market right now. My email is in the show notes, so all you have to do is send me a screenshot of your rating and review, and I'll get you that training. This episode is really, really a great one with my guy Ansel Troy out of Oakland. He has 2 tiny homes in the back of his property, and he also has converted his garage into an apartment. So he is triple house hacking. So very, very amazing story that I've never heard of. And so I know y'all will get a whole lot of value out of it. And then one more thing, if you are someone who lives in an expensive area like myself and you want to learn how to invest out of state, I strongly encourage you to sign up for my out-of-state investing coaching program, and I'll show you everything I know in order for you to buy your first out-of-state property. So whether it's out-of-state, whether it's a little bit further in your state, and it comes with a whole lot of value. We have weekly group coaching calls. You get access to an updated version of my course that'll show you from A through Z everything you need to do. And I'll be with you right by your side to help you reach that goal of buying your first out-of-state property. It's something that changed my life. And if you're ready for change, submit an application. The link is in the show notes, or you can simply go to outofstatemoney.com. All right, without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like, make sure you share, make sure you subscribe. If you're on audio, make sure you leave us that 5-star rating and review. We really appreciate the support. Very excited for this episode today. Here with me, I have Ansel Troy out of Oakland. Ansel, thank you so much for taking the time to come down and for jumping on the show, man.
Thank you for having me. My name is Ansel Troy, fresh out of Oakland, East Oakland to be specific. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Definitely, definitely. So shout out to my wife. She's actually the one who flagged your profile for me. She's like, I've seen this guy in the comments. I checked out his profile. What he's doing is pretty interesting. You definitely should check it out. And we spoke maybe like 2 days later on Zoom. And I'm excited about this episode because people talk about house hacking, you know, that, you know, get a 4-unit, live in one, rent the others out. But you're doing it in such a unique way with having 2 tiny homes in the back and also converting your garage to a studio. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen that before. Uh-huh. You know, I've seen like, you know, living in tiny homes and all this stuff, but the way you're doing it, I've never seen it. So I'm really excited about this episode, man.
I'm excited to talk about it because I kind of bump heads with people in the house hacking community. I'm like, it's a duplex. Where's the hack? You know what I mean? Like it's supposed to be a multifamily. But, you know, when you get into expanding your space, turning living rooms into bedrooms, you know, converting garages, you know, being creative, I think I kind of found it. And I say I got the sauce, you know, when we're talking about house hacking. Got the sauce. To go into detail, I don't know if we want to get to the story yet.
We'll get to it. That. Yeah, so that was my first question. So where did you get the idea of getting started with bringing tiny homes onto your property and renting those out?
So I initially purchased the home, and the prior renters had converted the garage into like this janky living space. It had no running water, and there was like a line of an electrical circuit going in there. And they just threw up some drywall, and they were renting it out to a small family of three, and everybody was using the inside bathroom. This is a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom home that I purchased. So the contractor who renovated it, I used a 203K FHA to buy the home. That's the FHA that has the renovation included in the mortgage. The contractor said, hey, you know, you can rent this out. And I said, ma'am, like, yeah, but I mean, there needs to be a bathroom. Like, it needs to be like, if I wouldn't live in it, I wouldn't rent it out. So that was number one. I converted that garage into a studio, and, you know, I started getting that check, and my mortgage was like $1,200, and I was renting it out for $800, the studio. And so the tiny house thing had picked up traction online. And I would post, you know, pictures about tiny houses. Like, I'm going to get one of these. I'm going to get one. We're talking 2015 is when I really started thinking about it. And I basically pulled out tape measure, went to the side of the house, and I said, you know what? I can do this, but it looks like it's going to be expensive. Like, I need some concrete. I need to modify this you know, cut out this gate. Make it swing open. I didn't have the skills or the tools or the money to pay somebody to do this work. So the first thing that I did was I turned the side of my house. I got one side that's the driveway, which leads to the detached garage that I converted into the studio. Had a tenant in there. I paid somebody to do that, and then the other side that had enough space for the tiny house, enough space for two tiny houses, and I had an avocado tree there as well. Paid somebody to put down a concrete slab, and got on YouTube, chopped the gate open, add some hinges to it so that it could swing open, and then I started looking for a tiny house. I found one up in Tuolumne County. It snows up there, like 2 hours away from Oakland. For $33,000, and pulled out a home equity line of credit, HELOC. Drove up there, checked it out, and you know, she said she wanted $33,000 cash. I'm thinking Airbnb because the other space I always had a long term tenant or short term tenant. People would stay for like a year or, you know, like 6 months. Midterm, that's what we call it now. I had midterm tenants in there. This one, I knew I was going to do Airbnb, and the numbers made sense for me. I said, you know, if I spend, if I buy this, my payment was $300. That was based off of interest alone. So the way the HELOC was structured was that I would be able to use it for the first 5 years, and I would only be making the interest payments. And so that came up to like $300 a month. And I said, if I can get $1,000 a month on Airbnb, then I'm good. Because I was doing everything myself. I would come home from work. I would, you know, do the cleaning. But rewinding back to the purchase, I bought it, brought it to the house, rented a pickup truck, drove home, had to pay somebody to back it into to that spot. Because, you know, backing in a trailer is something that is hard. Yeah. And pay somebody $100 to come, you know, whip it and get it up in there. And we launched the first tiny house on Airbnb you know, added a Keurig and some bedding and, you know, all that stuff. I'm definitely not as savvy. I wasn't savvy with Airbnb back then, but I launched that one. And then it took off because tiny houses were trending. Copped the other one, found that up in Napa for $35,000. I used a personal loan to buy that one. And that payment was like $425 a month. That was $35,000. And then, you know, so on a bad month, those tiny houses will pull in $6,000 on a bad month. And that's bad meaning I don't even want to consider that a bad month. That's just like
sound me. Pretty good to me.
That sounds like me blocking off my calendar and just not feeling like I want to clean because I do all my own cleaning, me and my son's mother. So that's the short version of my house hacking journey. I got this 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom that's got space on each side where I could actually slide another tiny house into the driveway.
Yeah.
Because the newer tiny house, when I got it, I parked that in my driveway and then parked my car in front of it because I had to push back the first one. I had to push that back, add some more concrete to my backyard, push that back, slid the other one in front of it. So I could actually, we got the 2 tiny houses, we got the detached garage. I have space for another tiny house in front of the garage and still space for me to park my car if I really wanted to get, you know, gangster with it, you know what I'm saying? So that's the short version of how I got these tiny houses.
Got it. So we got a lot to break down, man. So so when did you buy your property out in Oakland? Was it 2013?
2013, June 2013.
Yeah. How much was it?
It was, the seller got 125. It came up to 215 with the renovation. So there's the seller got their check and then the renovation amount that they hold in escrow to pay out the contractor. So it came up to 215 total. June 2013 is when I bought it.
How much do you think it's worth now?
It's worth about $500,000. Yeah, $500,000 without, and obviously the appraisal wouldn't include the garage and tiny houses. Just off a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom, 850 square feet in deep East Oakland. You know, location determines that. Yeah. You're gonna pay $500,000, around $500,000 today.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit more about that because East Oakland doesn't have the best reputation. So what made you want to purchase there? And I mean, you've been there 10 years later, got some pretty nice appreciation. But talk more about that, because a lot of people are in a position where they may want to buy a house and what they can afford is maybe not in what most would call a desirable area.
So being from Oakland, knowing the different neighborhoods, you can go from hot to cold in a block, right? Just like that. I also worked as a probation officer in San Francisco. So you would go from the projects to a $2 million home just by, you know, leaving. Once you exit that complex, that development, you are now on a literally across the street from the projects, you have $1 million homes. Now, so when people talk about, you know, safety and desirability, you know, look no further to a lot of metropolitan places where all you have to do is cross the street and it can go from, you know, from affordable homes or low income homes to $1 million property. So in Oakland is a block by block city where, you know, around the corner from my house is hot. It's similar to like a skid row down the street and around the corner, like a skid row, like a tenderloin. But on my street, you know, my neighbors work in construction. A lot of their wives don't work at all. It's just a regular blue collar neighborhood that does not have the aesthetics that people like. You're not going to find the manicured lawns. It's a lot of pickup trucks. There's a lot of illegal dumping. But in terms of like safety, all of my neighbors work, right? We work. And so when I bought this house, knowing Oakland, I knew that this wasn't, like, there's blocks that I wouldn't buy a house on.
Yeah.
Like, I just know. There's blocks, anytime you pull up, there's going to be, like, a bunch of bottles and a picture of somebody who passed away, right? Consistently, right? And there's a bunch of people loitering, posted in front of the liquor store. I wouldn't buy a house on that block to live, personally. And then there are other blocks that look similar, but they're different. So if you go down my block during the day, there's nobody on the street because everybody's at work. And if you go down my block at nighttime, there's nobody on the street because people are eating dinner, getting ready to go to bed and go to work again. But if you go down the street and around the corner, it's cracking, right? And so just knowing that, I didn't have any competition buying this house. My mindset was, I need to get a house that's easy to afford and I'll figure out the rest later, yeah. Right? I knew that this may not be the last house I buy. This may not be the fanciest house, but I was tired of my my landlord raising rent. They were actually moving from market rate to affordable. So my income, when I was living in an apartment in San Leandro, right next to Oakland, that I would no longer be eligible to live there. So I said, I just got to get a house, mm-hmm. right? I've always been a person to tinker and figure out things. I just need to give me a place to live. I'll figure out the rest.
Yeah.
215, I got that, right? And yeah. so it kind of will bleeds over into the gentrification conversation, because even though I'm from Oakland, I'm from East Oakland, grew up in low-income housing, I came back, you know, I was making like $95,000 a year at that time, 2013. And typically people, you know, with that income wouldn't be buying in that neighborhood. I could have got a different house in a more desirable neighborhood, but my mortgage is a lot higher. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I need something that I can easily afford.
Yeah.
And that's how I got that house.
Definitely. That makes a lot of sense. And I think a couple of things you mentioned, I think it's important for people to understand, like whether it's an investment property, whether it's a personal residence that you want to do whatever with or just live in, it's important to know your location. Mm-hmm. Like you need to understand the neighborhoods, you need to understand the blocks and all those things, because that could have residual impact, mm-hmm. right? I'm sure your quality of life has been much better because everybody on your block, they go to work. You know, there's certain stuff a couple blocks over you probably don't have to deal with, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Which is great for your quality of life, your peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
But people need to know the locations, like
absolutely.
Where they're purchasing. You can't just blindly purchase because mm-hmm. of the price or what have
right.
you. And I think the other thing is you went where you wouldn't have a lot of competition.
Right.
I'm sure even back then, if you were in a quote unquote more desirable area, that it would have been harder for you to
absolutely.
Get in there, you know, get something at a good price, put money into it and things of that nature. So I think it's important for people to look at that and consider that because, you know, you're starting, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to start somewhere. Obviously, you need to have some level of comfort, but
right.
you got to start somewhere. And I like your mentality because you said, let me just find somewhere to live and I'll figure it out. And that's what you did.
Absolutely. And also, I'm coming from a, you know, single income. Mm-hmm. So I realized that I cannot compete with a family, right? A two-income household. They can outbid me. So I did bid on two other houses and I got outbid, and I'm actually glad I did because I would not be able to do what I'm doing on those properties the way that I'm doing it here. So I kind of, this was like the perfect scenario for me. I didn't even know that this was the perfect scenario. I just knew that don't nobody want this house.
Yeah.
I'll get it. It's just me. And it was in horrible condition.
Yeah.
Which is it's actually, very difficult for things to match up where the construction costs in addition to the appraised cost, where everything matches up, where FHA will approve it, right? Very difficult. It worked out perfectly. And then I got this additional space. But just knowing, I can't say that I knew the market.
Yeah.
I'll just say that I knew the neighborhoods. Even people that were from Oakland was like, man, you on 85th? I'm just like, yeah, it's just 85th. It ain't, you know, it's not the Village, right? There's certain, you know, prominent neighborhoods in Oakland that have that reputation that has been earned, right? Some people wear it, you know, prideful, like, you know, I'm not from LA, but I hear rappers talk about, you know, the Gardens, you know, neighborhoods that have earned these reputations. But specifically where I am, it doesn't look quote unquote pretty, mm-hmm. But there's a lot of culture and you know, when we talk about the fact that people from all over the world are coming to my property, spending top dollar to stay there, despite the rooster, that my neighbor has. I don't even know who got that rooster.
Why do they have a rooster?
Well, you know what? My neighborhood is a predominantly Latino neighborhood.
Got it. Okay.
It was previously predominantly Black, but it's transitioned. And I mean, I've seen one time somebody was coming down the street on a bull. On a bull. I got the video. I pulled over my car and I whipped out my phone because nobody would believe me.
Oh my
riding
gosh.
A bull down the street. So we do have people that are that come from places where they had a farm.
Yeah.
And, you know, chickens and roosters and, you know, it's just it's some of their cultures. But yeah, there's a rooster. It doesn't bother me, but some people would be, you know, devastated.
Yeah.
There's a Harley Davidson, like two Harley Davidson clubs. One two blocks away, another one down the street from me. So you're going to hear loud Harleys throughout the day. We're on a major corridor. So it's a busy street. So it's a bus line.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a noisy street. The, you know, and there's some illegal dumping that happens frequently in the neighborhood. And there's a lot of blighted properties in the neighborhood. But it's not, when you look at the crime map, there's literally no crime on my street. Like Oakland has a map where they pinpoint, you know, calls for service. You look at my block, there's nothing. I'm across the street from an elementary school as well. And then there's that's also across the street from what some would consider a mega church. They own like the whole block.
Yeah.
You know, politicians will go there.
Right, right, right.
Presidential candidates will go to that church.
Yeah.
So they can come get these votes, you know. So it's not unsafe at all. And I just knew that people would know that. So there was no competition.
Definitely.
No competition.
Definitely. Love it, man. So thanks for that background. So let's jump back to the tiny home. So the first one was purchased for how much again?
$33,000.
And then you used HELOC for
I
it.
Use a HELOC.
Can you really quick, for those who may not know what a HELOC is, can you explain like what it is?
Yeah. HELOC is a home equity line of credit where the bank looks at how much your home is worth and how much you owe. And if there's some equity in there versus, you know, just pulling out the cash, you can pull out a line of credit based on your equity, and it's available for you to use. It's cash available for you to use. You may not even use it, but you know, a lot of homes have equity, but you can't like use it unless you sell or refinance. So that equity line of credit is just a way to use the money, and it's in an account, and usually there's like a date where like 5 years after where they'll cut off the line of credit, and then you just pay back on the principal and the interest. But it's just it's not like if you think of a credit card, right? That's just based on, you know, unsecured credit card, just trusting that you're going to pay it back.
Yeah.
But this equity line of credit is based on money that's in your home that you can use. And you just pay it back over time. If you use it or if you don't use it, it's a good vehicle for using the money, your money in your home that you own. It's dope, right? Yeah. Home equity line of credit.
Makes sense. And how much did you have to put into like getting the property up to standard, or was it kind of pretty much ready to go when you got it?
When I bought it?
When you bought the
home. I think I want to say 98,000 was the
I meant the tiny home.
Oh, the tiny house.
Yeah, yeah.
How much did I have to put in my property to get it ready for the tiny house, or
how much you had to put into the tiny house?
Oh, how much did I have to put into the tiny house? When I bought the tiny house, there was a woman and her husband living in it. Mm-hmm. And they divorced, she moved, so it came fully furnished.
Oh.
She said you can have everything. There was even a deck. They're like, "You want the deck too?" Right? I didn't take the deck. And they wanted to get rid of all of it. So it was fully furnished. And I added, to bring it to market, I added a Keurig, built a little coffee station. I added a couch. I put a TV in the loft area, a TV downstairs, towels from Costco, yeah, some plates. I can't give you a number, but I would say it was definitely like less than $4,000.
Yeah.
I did have to buy a new tankless water heater because the water heater that she had on there was rated for natural gas,
yeah.
and she was using propane. And so when I would run the water, it would like go hot and then it would go lukewarm.
Yeah.
And I didn't know why it was doing that. So I tried to DIY my way and figure out the problem until I finally broke down and had a plumber come out and he opened it up. He said, "You see this? This means natural gas. You're using propane." And I'm like, I wish you would have told me that, because the tiny house sat for months.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't figure this out and I didn't want to hire somebody. So I actually lost. I don't want to say I lost, but I could have went live much sooner had I known that I had to replace the hot water heater. And because I didn't want to tie into my natural gas and have like a gas line running, would have been a tripping hazard. I don't want to mess around with the public utilities like that. I just bought a new tankless water heater. I think it was like $500 back then, installed it myself. And after that, then I had to run an electrical line. Tiny house power is just like an RV power.
Yeah.
You just, you know, if you've ever been to like an RV camp, they have 30 amp or 50 amp power. This was a 30 amp. So that was like 2000, like 2,500 for the outlet to be installed by an electrician, something that I wouldn't pay for now. I can do it myself now.
Yeah.
So I would say maybe we'll say about 7,000.
Yeah.
Right. With the water heater and the electrical outlet. And the supplies, no more than 7,000 to bring it to market. And I would even say, and that's on the high end.
Yeah.
That's on the high end, because it was already pretty much furnished.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, I think 7 is a stretch. But if we just throw that number out there, just know that it's not that expensive to bring it to market. It was fully furnished.
Right, right. So is it? I heard you say upstairs, so it was like, it's like a loft area?
Yeah. So there's a sleeping loft area
with
a low ceiling. So you'd have to, you know, when you can't stand up there.
Yeah.
But I have a chair. So you can sit and chill, watch TV, lay in the bed, watch TV. So total square footage, including the loft, is 298 square feet, okay. 300 square feet. The loft is you can chill up there.
Yeah.
And there's the bed, and then in front of the bed, I got a record player and a chair, and you can chill up there.
That's dope, man. So you kind of started answering my next question. So the electricity, is it like plugged into the main house? Like, how does that work, the electricity?
So I have a breaker specifically for the tiny house, a 30 amp breaker, and then that runs to connect to like a car charger. People were like hook up a Tesla charger. That'll be one circuit specifically for that 50 amp, you know, electric vehicle charger.
Gotcha.
Or think about a washer or dryer outlet. That's 100% electric. Those big old outlets. So we have a 30 amp outlet that was one circuit, one breaker that runs under the house and along the side of the house. And that's what the tiny house plugs into. But, I do tiny house boot camps at my house.
Right.
And I could power that entire tiny house off of a regular wall outlet. And when I bring them to the house, I say, we're going to plug in this adapter and I'm going to plug it into this outlet over here. I take the 30 amp, turn it into like a 120 outlet. And then I go inside, I'll turn on the heater, I'll turn on the microwave, and I'll turn on the air conditioner, and I'll let them run. And I'll say, you would never run all these things at the same time, especially not the heater and the AC. You don't need a 30 amp outlet to power a tiny house, depending on what you got in there. But I use that as an example, showing people that if you don't have the money to pay for an electrician, all you need is an outlet and an extension cord, and you got enough power.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's dope, man. And then the water, how does it receive water?
So from a spigot, I use food grade water hoses. So each tiny house will have a water inlet, and you basically just use a water hose to go from your house, one of your house spigots. So most homes will have one in the backyard and one in the front that you can hook up a water hose to. I just hook up the water hose to the one. I have a dual. I just put a Y adapter on my on that spigot, uh-huh. a Y adapter, and then I have two food grade water hoses going into the tiny houses. They're just a different type of material where I don't know if you ever drank from a water hose as a kid, those green water hoses, but it tastes like it's got that taste. So a food grade water hose, it has a different type of a plastic material where you can like, that's what you want to use if you're going to be cooking or even drinking that water. And then they even have like RV filters where it'll filter the water before it goes into the house as well. But basically, just a water hose. Wow. Right. From my, so my the home water service connects to a water hose, and then the hose connects to the tiny house.
And it just replenishes as it needs it, right? Or do you have to actually like put it into a tank?
No.
It's just like automatic, like
It's like a it's like pretty much like a household. You know what I mean? It's just that the water service for your house is coming from the street, from the utility company.
Yeah.
And so the water service from the tiny house is coming from my house.
Got it.
Right. It's think of it as a different another sink. Right. Just another. So if I turn on my shower and my kitchen sink, and somebody's in the tiny house and they're running, it might reduce the pressure, but not significantly enough for most people to notice.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you were all in 40-ish for the first house. So when, what year did you go live?
Airbnb?
Yeah.
I went live 2018.
Got you. So did you have any reservations about if people would actually book because of the area and things like that?
Absolutely.
And what was it like just like starting out and starting to get some traction?
Absolutely. I learned that regardless of how well you describe a neighborhood, people may not even read the description. If they see it and they book it and they show up, I've had like three situations where people are like, I don't feel comfortable here. And then they, you know, cancel. And only three situations in like about 5 years, three or four situations. I remember those vividly. I didn't realize that people would want to come. And it was surprising to me when I realized that, I don't need, if there's millions of people coming to the Bay during the holidays and I got one tiny house, how many people do I need to appeal to fill up my calendar? I got 30 days in a month. I got one tiny house. If people are coming for like a, 3-day minimum. So what's 30 divided by 3? 10 people, right? I only have to appeal to 10 people. The Bay Area, the tourism is driven by San Francisco. And so like I looked at a chart where they said, millions of people come through SFO and the Oakland airport. I'm right next to the Oakland airport. If I only have to appeal to 10 people, then it's like, I shouldn't try to appeal to everyone, right? That was the secret sauce that I didn't know initially, that just dig into Oakland, like talk about how dope East Oakland is. And our street vendors with the fresh pupusas and tamales and churros, that you're not gonna get anywhere else. Once I realized, like, wait a minute, we got the sauce, right? This is Oakland. This is too short, right? Come get some Oakland culture and listen to that loud rooster my neighbors got. Like, come and get this experience. And there's more than enough people that want it. So, initially, I had some reservations, but business was booming since day one.
Yeah,
like, and I think I can attribute that to the Instagrammableness of tiny houses. How it was just such a thing that it was just cool. A lot of people don't realize that the average size of a hotel room is 300 square feet. I didn't know that either.
Wow.
And so people are not really under. Some people didn't know that the tiny house would be so spacious. Because tiny houses can be extremely big or small. But most people had an idea that, it's just like a kid's playhouse in the backyard.
Yeah.
It's like, nah, this is full kitchen, full stuff, dual, big sink. So business was good. I did have reservations, but the market surprised me. And that was an educational for me, learning that there is a market for people that want to stay in East Oakland or urban spaces, that they want that.
Definitely, mm-hmm. definitely. So how soon did you get the second one?
So that I got the second one in November 2020. Was it November 2020? So yeah, bought the first one 2017, went live on Airbnb September or October 2018. And then the second one, I bought it 2020.
Got it.
Around November 2020. Yep, on my birthday.
So what did you do differently in acquiring that second one, setting it up and all that? What did you learn from the first one?
The second one, I definitely, you know, had that experience. I already knew what was up. But at this time, the second one, I was just looking for something that would fit in front of it. I didn't care, you know, I didn't even care about the condition of it, because now I'm Mr. DIY. And I'm like, just give me another, you know, give me another space. And now with the second one, I'm like, how can I make this go viral? So I really, really, really took my time on the interior decor, where I'm like, okay, I know the game. People are looking for Instagrammable experiences, photo worthy experiences. Tiny houses are still cool. And all right, let me get into my design bag and spend hours and hours on Pinterest, on Google, reading different books on interior design. Like, what is going to get people to spend, you know, the most per night in East Oakland. So I spent a lot of time just literally sitting in this new tiny house, trying to figure out, like, psychologically, how would somebody feel wow. when they got here. But let me rewind, because you asked me about the process of buying this one. I used a personal loan from, and this is game, from a lender called Lightstream. Lightstream is the lender, and they do unsecured loans, but they require excellent credit. So I bought my Tesla with Lightstream, and they just wire you the money, and they say, don't send us the title. A lot of people don't know about Lightstream Bank, and but you have to have excellent credit, because I'm like, wow, they just wired me 50 grand, and they say, you keep the title. The interest rates are a little higher, just a little, Lightstream. And so I used a personal loan from them to get this tiny house. My payment was $425. And, you know, they wired me the money, went out to Napa, checked it out. It was built by a carpenter and his daughter. And he actually, you know, messed up in some areas. He didn't, like the electrical wasn't complete. Like, there were a couple wire, like, the way he wired up the hot water heater that wasn't sufficient, it could have went bad, right? I didn't know what I didn't know, and I made some mistakes buying this one because I didn't do a total inspection. But I still would have bought it even with the inspection if I would have said, hey, this needs to be addressed, but I want it, because they were trying to sell it for $75,000, mm-hmm. and I got it for $35,000. And, you know, and there's no, we go back to no competition. Who's buying tiny houses?
Right.
Right. They're sitting, you know, all over the United States, just sitting. And there's no real market, and there's nobody competing to pick these tiny houses up.
Right.
So, got the financing, got it, picked it up, you know, fixed a couple of the issues. I tapped into the first tiny house's hot water heater that provides hot water to both tiny houses. Cause it's the same size as my home has a hot water heater.
Yeah.
Same size. It's more than sufficient. And they're, you know, back to back. So got the financing, acquired it, went and got a U-Haul, hitched it to the U-Haul, drove it back to the house. And that was the acquisition process. But the big difference from a business standpoint was, being able to get $250 a night off of this tiny house that is smaller and has fewer amenities, but the design got me in Architectural Digest. It got me in the Wall Street Journal. It got me in Business Insider. Everything came from the second tiny house and how Airbnb PR reached out to me to hear my story. because I guess the design triggered their algorithm.
Wow.
And, you know, Travel and Leisure, USA Today, Black Enterprise, it was that one that I want to say ultimately got me here with you. Yeah. Because I believe your wife might have seen my profile. Yep. And looked and checked me out. And that second tiny house, it also allowed me to resign from my 14-year career in probation.
Right.
So, yeah, that was the second one, was the game changer.
That was the one.
Yeah, the game changer. Now I'm Mr. Tiny House.
Amazing, man. So you charge $250 a night for the newer one?
No. So that was at its peak.
At its peak. Okay.
Right when I was raising it up.
Yeah.
That was the highest nightly rate that I got. Because, you know, hotel prices are like airline ticket prices. Mm-hmm. Somebody could be in for $100 a night. Somebody could be in for $250 a night. It just depends on when you book it and what's going on. If there's a concert, I'm right near the Oakland Coliseum. If there's a concert going on, that price is going to be higher versus just a random Wednesday and Thursday.
Right.
So your pricing is dynamic.
Yeah.
But the most that I've gotten for a nightly rate was $250.
Got it.
And again, we're in Deep East Oakland. Right. And this is a small space. I've had people do their honeymoons, you know, in my hood, you know.
Wow.
Straight up. It's blown my mind, but it lets me know that it's for who it's for. Right. Yep. And in a market where short term rentals can be competitive, I found my niche. And I don't even think I don't see other hosts as competition because we're not playing the same game.
Yep.
I'm not even playing the same game. I'm playing the how can I get into a magazine game?
Yeah.
And if I can get their attention, then somebody gonna book it. So now my mindset with the short-term rentals is like, how can I get back in Architectural Digest?
Yeah.
And how can I do it cheaply? You know, and I got that sauce.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Have you thought about expanding and helping other people design their tiny homes and figure out how to acquire them and things like that?
I've thought about it, but being self-aware, I really don't like working for people. And there's a freedom associated with, you know, not having an expectation to deliver on that. But I also don't want to limit myself. So it's still something that I think about because there's a nonprofit in Alabama that reached out to me and they want to bring me on as a consultant to design one of their spaces.
Okay.
So I said, I'm open. We're actually scheduling meetings right now. So, it's not something that I want to make a career out of.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that next year that I wouldn't be a full-time interior designer.
Yeah.
I would have to do it my way, but who knows what the future looks like. And I think I'm kind of good at it now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, man, there's a lot of different directions you can go in it.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think even the consulting side, it's like there's not maybe not necessarily an expectation of you going in picking stuff and like you're just giving what your opinion is and they can kind of do with it as you will. So it's almost like you're testing the waters a little bit. Mm-hmm. And maybe you'll find that the consultation is what you're comfortable with as opposed to taking on the design responsibility. Mm-hmm. And all those things. But that's good, man.
You hit on consulting. So I have started to do some consulting. I launched, you know, I want to say I have a Calendly, you know what I mean? Where people, and it's on my Linktree where people can hit me up, and I've done like four or five and it's cool. Like if that could be like a full-time thing, I would definitely do that. I think that, I've paid people to, you know, to consult before I left my job. I paid somebody from TaskRabbit, to put together an IKEA. It was something from IKEA. He was charging $100 an hour, and I just wanted to pick his brain. So when he got to my house, I said, "Hey, I don't need you to build anything. I just want to talk to you. How did you get to like $100 an hour on TaskRabbit?" He's like, "Are you serious?" I'm like, "Yeah, I just want to talk." And so he put his tool down, and I said, "But I built this. I built this. I installed that." I said, "Do I have the skills that it takes to do what you do?" He says, "I can't do any of this. Like, I just put together IKEA furniture." And I'm like, "And people pay you $100 an hour?" He's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, all right. So that was like actually confirmation that, you know, me submitting my resignation if things didn't work out with the short-term rentals, that I had the skills to make money, you know, picking up odd jobs on TaskRabbit. I never actually did that. But on the consulting side, I paid him. He thought he was coming to put some furniture together, but I just wanted to pick his brain.
Yeah.
And so now I realize that there are people who want to pick my brain. And I'm more than happy, you know, I'm more than happy to sit down and let them ask me questions about Airbnb or tiny houses. Like, I mean, I think that people should definitely invest in that, right? If somebody is doing something that you want to do, you know, it's cool to say, hey, can I take you out for coffee? Mm-hmm. But I think you would get a better response if you're like, hey, if somebody doesn't have, you know, a calendar set up, you know, ask them, you know, how much, you know, would it, you know, can I pay you for 30 minutes to an hour to really, you know, to talk to you about something that you're doing and what you want to do. And if I could pick something to do full time, I would just do consulting. Yeah. I would say, man, screw this Airbnb. Talk to me. For real, for real.
Yeah, love it, man. So how much are you bringing in on average these days a month
for
both of the tiny homes?
Just Airbnb?
Yeah.
I would say on average, 6,000. Last year was the first year that I did it full time. Mm-hmm. And I think Airbnb, I think it was 60 something. I don't remember the number offhand. It might have been 69. Mm-hmm. I also block off a lot of days.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about full occupancy,
right?
Or even, you know, maximum nightly rate. The industry says you want to be 80% booked versus 100% booked. And the industry says if you're 100% booked, then your pricing is too low. But for me, I block off a lot of time because I've got other stuff going on.
Yeah.
So I haven't maximized it. But from a theory standpoint, also want to mention, I had a long-term tenant who moved out last year in the studio.
Right.
She moved out September. So she was paying $1,000 a month.
Right.
So with her and the Airbnb, we'll say $7,000 a month just off the backyard with my mortgage right now is $1,600
because
I refinanced that HELOC back into the house. So my mortgage is $1,600, and off the detached garage and the two tiny houses, we were, you know, $7,000 would be an average month. Not even aggressive with it. I've never tried to be booked 30 days.
Yeah.
So now that the studio, I don't know if you want me to speak on that.
Let's talk about it.
So that tenant moved out, right? I had always, from 2014 until then, I always had a midterm tenant in there.
Yeah.
She was there for 4 years. Jessica, best tenant ever. She moved to the East Coast, and I'm like, oh, we can put this on Airbnb.
Yep.
But now that I got this sauce from the first one to the second tiny house, you know, generating that media response, I'm like, okay, now let's do it again. So I went in and converted that into like a theater / spa vibe. I got this 86-inch TV, and then I got this like open format layout with an all cement shower and deck with this tub where the tub is right next to the bed. You get out. There's literally no privacy. So when people book, you know, I'm hoping that they're a couple, right?
Yeah.
Because everything is straight up open, open layout. And the goal for that one was like the last one. Like, I want people to not only book, but I want press to come in and ask about it. Mm-hmm. And it's already happening. So now we're looking at theoretically $9,000 a month from the backyard. I just launched that one this month. We're still in July, right? I just launched it and the calendar's filling up. I launched it at a very affordable price. And, you know, you got to get your calendar filled up and you got to get those good reviews. So I kind of go above and beyond with like extra amenities and like more drinks and stuff. So now we have three spaces on the Airbnb platform that I want to say an average month should be, it should be $9,000 a month. And, you know, that changes. This has changed a lot, even from an operational standpoint. Like, can you manage three people checking in and checking out on the same day? Mm-hmm. Do you want to be working that hard? How much are these Lysol wipes costing me per turnover? How many hours am I putting into this? Does it still make sense to do these minimum two-night stays? Or does it make sense for me to say 7-day minimum and let me focus on my consulting business instead of turning over these places? I feel like I'm a glorified cleaner, right? Yeah. Because cleaning is the backbone to the short-term rental industry. Like, I'm cleaning and doing laundry. Yeah. I'm not going to sit here and say that all of my time is consumed. We're talking about maybe 12 hours a week of actual direct, you know, labor, which is, you know, I'm not going to complain about that. But I want to monetize my mind and teach people how to do this. I think that's a better way for me to scale. I don't want 100 tiny houses, right? I would like to get into you know, more content creation and more showing people that, hey, I bought this cheap house, I got these cheap tiny houses, this is what I do full time now. I'm not rich, I'm comfortable, I still eat filet mignon, I flew here first class. That's not a flex, but I do like leg room.
Yeah.
And I can afford an extra $100 on the ticket just off of my backyard, right? I'm not one of them people to be like, hey, come and learn this so you can make the money that I'm making.
Yeah.
Because I'm, you know, it's not that. It's more so the freedom of time, the freedom to be creative.
Yeah.
This house hacking has allowed me to consider things that I never would have considered. Right now I'm thinking I can be an interior designer. I can be a consultant. I can, you know, create content about tiny houses. Is Netflix going to hit me up so I can do a tiny, you know, be the tiny house, the house hacking, you know, show? Or can I produce it myself. I don't need Netflix. I have this $1,600 mortgage. That's the kicker right there. That first, the crazy house, you know what I mean? Knowing that even if this doesn't work out on Airbnb, the market where I live, I can rent each space out for $1,500 easily. So that's $4,500 right there. And my mortgage is still $1,600, right? That really allows me to take risk. Like, and they're not even really risk because I still got groceries and my mortgage is still paid. And now I have these midterm, long-term tenants where I don't have to do too much of anything.
Yeah.
And I'm a DIYer, so I can go in and fix it myself. You know, maybe I want to go to school for journalism. Maybe I want to go to law school. Maybe I want to go to film school, right? It's really allowed me, these tiny houses and this property has really been a game changer. And I'm not sitting here as this ridiculously wealthy real estate guy, right? I just have a really low overhead and a good operation going at my house.
Man, I love it. And what I like the most about it is it's extremely relatable. Like, mm-hmm. It's doable, right? The average cost of an ADU, which is an accessory dwelling unit, basically another structure on your land, could be hundreds of thousands of dollars, especially in California.
$200,000 in the Bay, if you're lucky.
Right. And you're all in for both properties, less than $100,000.
Yep.
That's doable for somebody who has the space in their backyard. So I think that's the greatest part of this, because this is not something that's so far above everyone's head. Mm-hmm. Like, you could figure out how to get $30,000, $40,000 to get a tiny home. And you pretty much gave the instructions on, at minimum, what you can do to get up and running. Mm-hmm. It feels a lot more doable than getting an ADU, which is like a whole situation. You got to get permits and contractors and all this stuff. Some people might not even bother because of the complexity of it. Whereas what you just shared and spent this whole time talking about, it's very doable. Mm-hmm. It's within reach.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even, you know, for people that are looking to get a duplex and house hack that way. Hack, I don't think that's a house hack. but, you know, in Oakland, we're talking $700,000, $800,000 if you're lucky for a duplex, versus you spend $500,000 on this very modest household this very modest property, and then 30K on a tiny house that you slide up in there. That's your extra unit. And the good thing about these tiny houses on wheels is that you can get a U-Haul truck and get you one wherever it is in Canada. If you got to go pick it up in Canada, drive it back. There are some really dope tiny houses selling for 30 grand and less if you just search for them. And there's no competition in buying them. They're literally just sitting there waiting for a buyer because people don't really know what a tiny house is. It a real house? Yes, it's hard construction framed like your house in a smaller footprint on a trailer, like more sturdy than a tough shed, right? Like literally real framing, 2x4s, real roof. It's good. These tiny houses are going to last. They're built to last 100 years. Like your house is built to last 100 years plus because of the way they're constructed. It's one of the reasons why I didn't get an RV. I was thinking about an RV, but that's like plastic, yeah. Right? It's not built to last. It's not built, you know, to do what a standard house does. But it's when I'm talking to the average working class person, you can get 30,000, right? Yeah. You may not be able to go and get 500,000, but you could definitely get 30,000, even if some. And even if it's somebody that's saying, hey, I want to have my own space. I don't have land, but I have a family member who has a spot for me to park it. Maybe I can pitch this to them. And then they can educate them on, hey, this is how you do the water. I only need an outlet to plug into. I teach people about the different type of toilets because that's the biggest question that I get is plumbing.
Yeah.
Tell people about these different type of toilets that you can use. But it's definitely for the average working class person. Mm-hmm. You can figure out a way to get the money to do this.
Yep.
If it's not right now, you can plan for it, you know, and that's who I'm speaking to.
Definitely. I love that, man. So a lot of people don't like short-term rentals in their area, and you know, different cities have been cracking down on it and mm-hmm. things like that. Do you foresee any of that happening in the Bay Area? And so that's the first question. The second question is like, what are your thoughts on people who don't like short-term rentals?
So regulations are coming for my city. They're actually engaging with Airbnb right now, and they're supposed to vote on it this fall. But I found out that I found out a number that I'm not supposed to know, that the city is getting a hefty check from Airbnb. It's in their interest. We have a $360 million deficit in Oakland, budget deficit, this year. The money that they get from the occupancy taxes that Airbnb writes them a check for, hotels as well, guests have to pay this tax. It goes into the general fund. It funds the zoo. It funds a couple of other things that are significant to the city of Oakland. So regulations are coming. I foresee them being I'm not against regulations, mm-hmm. right? You can't have the wild, wild west where people are doing anything and everything. I'm not against them. I am against, you know, somebody saying that this doesn't belong in a residential neighborhood. And thinking that, you know, there's going to be a party where a violent fight breaks out. You have to be a responsible short-term rental owner. And so those that are simply looking at it as an investment vehicle where they're hands off, like completely hands off, if you're not, you know, being a good steward or a good host, those stories will be picked up by the media and it makes us all look bad as short-term rental hosts. So I think, you know, regulations are not necessarily bad. I hope that my city gets it right. If they say that you need a permit and you got to pay this fee, I'm with that, right? But if you're saying no, you know, like Dallas did, no, absolutely not. Not in residential neighborhoods. I think that's whack. So as it relates to the second question was, how do I feel about them being in neighborhoods? Was that the same?
Oh, you answer both. You answer both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, thankfully I'm in a neighborhood that a lot of it is not a desirable neighborhood. I don't have ain't no Karens in my neighborhood. In fact, most of my neighbors are house hacking. The neighbor next door to me just converted their garage into a living studio. Mm-hmm. And this is an older couple. He's retired. He actually did all the work himself. But this is, this neighborhood has a lot of multi-generational families. So up and down the block, they have converted their garages into studio long before I bought my house.
Yep.
This is something that people have been doing a long time. We have a structure, right? Somebody can live here. And also one of the things about my community, you know, Oakland is a major entry point for people coming to the United States. I mean, California was Mexico, right? Yeah. Originally, right? So a lot of these people are coming home. And in California, I want to say it's predominantly, you know, Latino, I believe. I could be wrong. So there's a lot of families that are used to, you know, staying together on one property, mom, dad, grandpa, grandpa, everybody's here on one property. It makes so much sense. You don't have to pay for childcare, right? It makes so much sense. It's like everybody helping everybody out. Cooperative economics, that is, that may be a cultural thing, but that my neighbor's house hack. So nobody in my neighborhood would hate on it, right? If I was in another neighborhood, they probably would have hated it, but tiny houses are legal in Oakland.
Yeah.
As of November 2021, they weren't when I bought mine. They were considered a blight. And each tiny houses are considered a trailer, technically.
Yeah.
Unless you've had it certified as an RV. My tiny houses are just trailers. They have license plates with houses on top. So they fell under the blight ordinance. You can't have a trailer on the side of your house. It is considered a blight. But as of November 2021, the city changed that.
Yeah.
So now you could literally build a tiny house community on your property as long as they're 6 feet away from each other, each tiny house.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with short-term rentals in neighborhoods as long as you're doing it the right way. And I also feel like, you know, telling me what I can and can't do with my property. Obviously, I can't be running a refinery, mm-hmm. right, in my neighborhood. I shouldn't be doing, like, if I started, like, a barbecue restaurant and I got these smokers running, right, that impacts a lot.
Yeah.
But simply allowing somebody to rent out their space, I am not against that.
Yeah.
And I am very, you know, in favor of rules that allow us to monetize our property, but also make sure that people do it the right way.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Last question before we wrap. Oakland has drastically changed over the years. I mean, you've been there your whole life, so you've seen it. What are your thoughts on the gentrification that's been going on? What's your perspective?
Great question. Gentrification. You know, I'm going to keep it a buck with you.
Yeah.
Gentrification has bought some delicious restaurants to Oakland. Gentrification has pushed a lot of people out. I also want to make it very clear that we can't dictate who purchases a house that is for sale, right? If there is a house for sale, the seller, you know, is able to choose the best offer, right? Whatever offer they deem, you know, the best for them. It's their property. They get to pick who they're going to sell it to. And if that happens to be a developer, or if that happens to be a corporation, you know, that's the market, right? So if we want to keep our communities more communal, and we don't want people to get pushed out, then the home that your grandparents or great grandparents purchased, then don't sell it, right? People have to, you know, get into estate planning if you want to preserve these neighborhoods. But there's the other side of that is, if you let your community go to waste and somebody sees it as a gold mine, that happened in West Oakland. And there's some predatory stuff in there as well, right? If you give some, if you offer somebody $100,000 for a property that you know is worth $400,000 and they don't know any better, right? You know, and they accept that. I mean, they didn't have to accept it, but you know, like the signs that say, you know, cash for homes. If you find somebody in a bad situation and you're able to help them out, I can't be mad at that person for taking that $100,000 because they weren't educated and they didn't realize the value of the home. They just saw dollar signs. I'll take it. I can't be mad at them. You know, I don't like gentrification. I think that there's a better way to improve neighborhoods. I don't like it from an institutional perspective, because I can't compete with you know, Warren Buffett. What's his company? I can't compete with Berkshire Hathaway. Yeah, like, none of us can compete with them, right? We just can't compete with them. But it's free market, right? The market is the market. Whoever comes with the biggest bag will typically get the house. And people have to hold on to what they have if they want to preserve their communities. And then we also have to take care of our communities so that we can get these restaurants coming in that want to, you know, set up shop, you know, so that, you know, I mean, we got places popping up with these $6 donuts, you know what I'm saying? that are delicious, but they're only coming because there's people that are willing to pay for these $6 donuts. So it's kind of like, you know, if we don't invest and patronize the people that are here, then other people will come in and invest and bring their money into it. And I'm just a working class guy with one house. I can't compete with Berkshire. So gentrification has a negative connotation, but it also, there are some situations where people will look around and be like, "Hey, this is nice." You know, like, I mean, let's just keep it real. You know, the Brooklyn that Jay-Z grew up in is not the Brooklyn that we now see. And sometimes an influx of capital will increase the quality of life. And it's unfortunate that some people are unable to afford to remain there. And how do we deal with that when we want the best for our families, but we don't want people to not be able to afford it? It's a good conversation, and I'm kind of on the fence about gentrification, because I don't want to see anybody be pushed out, and I also don't think that I also think that as Black people, we're typically the people being pushed out, right? And that's whack. So there's got to be a better way. We don't, you know, Berkshire Hathaway can't come in and buy up the block. You know, that's something that we have to talk about, you know, with our families, and see how we can preserve what we have for generations moving forward.
Definitely appreciate that, man. This has been a great interview. I've been really looking forward to this. I gotta come up to Oakland, man, and get some. Yes, we gotta collaborate on some content or
slide
something.
Through, man.
So I gotta put my hands on it and see how all this looks. I saw the pictures and everything, and it just looks amazing. So mm-hmm. I'd love to see that in person sometime. But I appreciate it, man. This is, again, something that's very realistic for mm-hmm. a lot of people, something that's within reach and not so far over our heads. So I appreciate you just breaking everything down so plainly mm-hmm. for everyone. So definitely appreciate it, man.
Thank you. Can I come back?
Of course, man. We definitely, all right. Yeah, part two, we got to do. Part two, we got to do it in Oakland, man.
Okay.
I come with my camera, a couple mics, and we'll do something, man.
I think that would be dope to drive around and show your audience, like, in real life. I would love to, man, you are welcome, man. And if you want to come stay in the tiny houses, man, you know what I'm saying? It's on me. It's all good.
Oh, I appreciate that,
all
man.
All good. But thank you for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here, bringing me in front of your audience. And I'm very appreciative.
Definitely. So last thing, where can people find you and keep up with what you have going on?
People can find me on Instagram. That's the best way to find me. Tiny Oakland is the is the profile name, T-I-N-Y Oakland, O-A-K-L-A-N-D, or you could just Google me, Ansel Troy. I got a lot of articles out there. That's dope. You can look up Ansel Troy and check out what I got going on. I'm so excited about helping people. One tiny house bringing in an extra $1,500 a month for somebody is life changing for a lot of people. It's life changing for a lot of people. I'm gonna be putting out content. The three tiny houses are popping. The studio, the other two tiny houses. And this year is going to be content. I'm launching a tiny house academy. I don't know what I'm going to call it, but I'm going to be launching that. So if anybody's interested in learning, just hit me up on IG.
Love it. And thank you everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you haven't already, if you're on YouTube, make sure you like, make sure you share, subscribe. If you're on audio, make sure you leave us that 5-star rating and review. Thank you so much. Look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.